Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Sarah Font. I'm an associate professor of sociology and public policy at Penn State.
And Sarah, thank you so much for being with us, Prof. It's great to have you here. So, my first question is to ask you what's going on for you right now? What's dynamizing, preoccupying, worrying, interesting you?
I would say the thing that has been on my mind the most recently is the continued fallout of the drug epidemic for young children who are in the care of parents who are unable to overcome addiction.
And about 25% of our listeners are in the US. So in that context, I'm wondering if you could explain to us a little bit about what this drug epidemic is.
Sure. So I know it's not only the U.S. that's having, some of these issues, but I'll say in the U.S. context, we're continuing to see about 100,000 overdose deaths each year. We're, continuing to see very high rates of babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome or other types of drug exposures. And we're also seeing, there's been increasing sort of news coverage coming out about young children who have died because either they've gotten into their parents' drug supply, they've been, accidentally left in a hot car or in other sort of unsafe locations while their parents are intoxicated. So there's just sort of a lot of issues around how substance use affects parenting that the US in general and the child welfare system in particular hasn't quite figured out how to handle.
And when you're referring to these drugs, are we discussing things that are prescription drugs mostly, or so-called recreational drugs that are causing these addictions and this conduct?
So at this point, what we're mostly talking about is street drugs, so non-prescribed substances, and especially fentanyl and a sort of a newer formulation of methamphetamine that is more dangerous and more likely to induce psychosis than versions in prior decades.
Right. And these things are affecting all sectors of society in class, race, gender terms.
So I think that's a little bit difficult to say in terms of in terms of things like, race and gender, right? The US generally keeps statistics on things like fatalities. Right, it's very hard to accurately capture use because people are unlikely to accurately report that or that, there's selection to who participates in surveys and that sort of thing. But certainly one of the things that we've seen in the US context associated with the drug epidemic is a large increase in particular cities in the homeless population. So there's some concentration certainly among the most disadvantaged sectors of society.
And does this correlate at all with mental health issues?
So on in general, I think about half of people who have a substance use disorder have a co-occurring mental illness. But and so certainly people can use substances as a way of trying to alleviate the symptoms of a mental illness. I would say there's a pretty high comorbidity there.
I used to live in downtown Los Angeles, and there it was said that, as you know, there's a vast array of homeless people, allegedly the highest urban concentration in the global north. And it was also said that there was a strong correlation with mental illness, and often people who were veterans and who suffered from post-traumatic stress issues connected to their service. Although, as you say, all these things are not necessarily easy to come to terms with. When it comes to the implications for children of these folks, which I think is your main focus, perhaps you could also outline the extraordinary patchwork that is the United States, because it is a federal system, and yet one where there is also a major role for central government when it comes to child protection and welfare services. I'm not asking you to go through state by state, but if you could just give us a bit of a picture, I think that would be really helpful.
Sure. So with federal funding and some federal oversight, each state operates its own child protection and foster care services. And they have similar features, right? So we have what's called mandatory reporting, and that means that professionals typically, but a designated group of people, if they're aware of suspected abuse or neglect, they're obligated to report that to child protection agencies in their local area. These systems all have functions where they send out a person to conduct an assessment or investigation to determine whether abuse or neglect has occurred. And they have some obligation, if they find evidence of abuse or neglect, to intervene to prevent that from happening again. Typically, in most cases, the intervention is some form of services like counseling or parenting support. And then in a smaller subset of cases, that would involve foster care or out-of-home placement.
Right. And what is the history to this? Is this something that starts in the latter part of the 20th century alongside a more generalized welfare state? And how does it relate to charities, non-government organizations, third sector entities like religious institutions and so on?
Yeah, so, and I'm certainly not an expert in the history of child protection. So this will be sort of broad brush, but in the early stages, right? So in the early 1900s and before, it was largely an informal system, orphanages largely run by religious groups and other sectors. And they primarily cared for children who were abandoned or their parents were incarcerated or other things that weren't necessarily directly tied to abuse and neglect. It wasn't that the state was removing the child per se. It wasn't until the 1960s or so that we started to see the emergence of our sort of modern child protection system. And that came about due to largely growing public awareness of physical abuse and children appearing with sort of unusual injuries that started to be reported out by Henry Kemp, was the author of this book called The Battered Child, that kind of got a lot of public attention and led to federal action that required states to develop these more formal systems to institute mandatory reporting and other things. And so since the 1960s, the system has grown more and more formalized. There's been more federal oversight in terms of the circumstances that foster care can be used in, what it should look like, how long kids can be there, and all of those sorts of things. So we've only really had this current system for about 70 years.
And again, in a very broad brush way, that's doing an injustice to such a vast country with so many people living under such varied circumstances. I know you've been involved in evaluating the system in various empirical ways. And often, when people ask me about the United States and ask me about the X system, I end up saying there's never one system. We're talking about dozens and dozens in many cases, and yet there are some generalities that one can produce. If you were asked by somebody to give an evaluation for the bourgeois media, a quick few sentences for interviews, saying the system works, the system doesn't work, this is what needs to change, what would be the sorts of things that you'd be saying? Now, thankfully, here you have more time to answer that and in a more nuanced way. And I'm suggesting.
I would say, in general, states have a lot of the same challenges, which are generally a rapidly turning over workforce. It's very hard to staff these systems. I would say there's a high rate of essentially undetected or under-responded to maltreatment. So children who die of maltreatment in the U.S. are largely children who are already known to the system, and the system did not adequately protect them. But I would say a lot of states do better than others, right? So there are some states who act more quickly to intervene. When they act, they are able to use foster care for a shorter amount of time than other states because they can provide services more quickly. They can assess readiness for reunification more quickly, those sort of things. But on the whole, I would say the challenges across systems tend to be pretty similar. Systems just make very different decisions about how to try to cope with this.
And what about the grand political divides that we get in the United States? Are they relevant to understanding how children are protected and how well they're protected? Is there a position that says we need more state involvement, we need more intervention versus a position that says leave this to families, they can be trusted, or leave this to the church or whatever it might be?
So this is one of those, I think, maybe the horseshoe theory of politics applies, where I would say there are segments on sort of the far left and also on the far right who have turned against the idea of child protection and state involvement in the family, right? Who kind of reject the idea of that writ large. However, I would say it's sort of the broad center. There's, I would say, disappointment with how the system functions, but a general support for the idea that the government has a responsibility to children when their parents are unable to provide minimally adequate care.
And Prof. Sarah, if I'm reading your bio correctly, my understanding is that you trained as a social worker, yeah? And
Yes.
so what dynamized you to choose social work as a field to get involved in this area? And I'm not asking you to be massively self-revelatory, but just to the extent that you're comfortable, so that people who might be interested in this field get an idea of what one might be seeking to do.
Yeah. Well, so I'll say I was always interested in, sort of the broad array of professions that would be considered sort of helping professions.
Yes.
But I kind of just stumbled into child protection, because, well, I ended up in social work because of the sort of social science that we majors. It seemed the one that had a clearly defined sort of job role attached to it. Like I considered, psychology or social psychology or sociology, and I was like, I don't know what the path from that is,
What do I
right? I
do
was
when
like,
I
social.
grow up?
Exactly. So I ended up in social work, and it just happened that at the time I was graduating, my home state of Michigan had actually faced a major lawsuit. So in the U.S., it's common for these nonprofit groups to sue the state on behalf of children in foster care when they think that the foster care system is doing an inadequate job of providing care.
Right.
And my home state was facing one of these lawsuits. And one of the things that was related to settling the lawsuit was that they had to hire a lot more caseworkers because the caseloads were so high that things weren't getting done. So I was one of the 500 caseworkers that they had to hire. And so I ended up doing investigations for a few years, and then I was sort of encouraged to go back to school to do the to go on more of a research path. So.
No, that's so interesting. Thanks. I so often very successful people such as yourself have an accidental moment in their professional lives. There's something conjunctural, there's something in the wider political economy that's happening, as you've just sketched for us. In this case, a lawsuit and a sudden efflorescence of job opportunities in the field. So you go back to school, you get the doctorate. What was it like re-entering academia, having been a practitioner? Did you find yourself skeptical about professorial research or theoretical ideas or political perspectives or whatever, having been out there helping?
Yeah, I think for a lot of reasons, I didn't consider myself a natural fit for academia. I'm from a pretty blue collar background. My parents didn't go to college, and so I realized pretty quickly, especially in doctoral programs, where I think there's a lot of fairly advantaged students that we just saw the world in really different ways. And I think their perspective was that I was cynical, and my perspective was that they were naive. So yeah, it was an interesting, and maybe both were true.
Well, I guess that's interesting. We're not going to talk for too long about your doctoral experiences, but many of the listeners to this may well be graduate students themselves. Did you find there were areas where you guys could coalesce, or did that bifurcation of, I think you're naive, I think you're cynical, present a kind of block between you?
No, so I have lots of friends who, share different, have different worldviews than I do. And I think in some ways, they are, they're not wrong about some of the things. It's just that I think I am less convinced of the, what do I want to say? I think one of the things that I think was sort of a major sticking point in these conversations was I believe that people make choices even in the face of significant constraints. Whereas I think a lot of my cohort mates really believed that the constraints, sort of removed human agency, particularly in the face of things like poverty.
So this is in part an argument about free will and
Yes.
the idea of an ongoing agency versus something that is determined by social relations. Is that another way of putting it?
Yeah, and I think these debates keep playing out in the child protection space because there's a sort of discomfort with the idea that the vast majority of parents who come to the attention of the child protection system are from low income or socially disadvantaged backgrounds. And so the question is, are the conditions in which they and their children find themselves in the product of all of those constraints or the product of choices or both?
And I suppose inevitably this can lead to a tendency to blame individuals or not blame them or discount individual responsibility in the name of, as I said, determining forces of social relations. And presumably, again, the truth is somewhere in the middle, when there are
Right.
elements of all these things at play. And I think anybody who's studied violence with any degree of seriousness, we would appreciate that sort of nature nurture distinctions and behavioralism distinctions can never be absolute. I think that there's got to be some kind of rapprochement. And now that you've become naive as a consequence of being a prof, no, but are people still calling you cynical, or are you now seen as a solid researcher?
Well, I would say the field is very divided at the moment. And I would say, unfortunately, I think it's become very ideological. So I would say there are certainly people who would continue to find me cynical. But, both in my personal life and professionally, I have seen firsthand a lot of the situations that I examine in my research. And I just think that being compassionate about both the parents and the children doesn't require that we remove them of any responsibility or agency.
And let's get on to how you do your research, if that's possible. Tell us a little bit, because you have experiential history as a worker in the field. And obviously, that's important. So, does that give you an ethnographic eye? How do you go about finding out the things that you know?
So I think the jumping off point for a lot of my research questions is really I'll be in a meeting, or I'll be reading the newspaper and I will see a claim, that someone makes pertaining to child welfare. And I'll say, well, that's interesting. Is that true? And then I try to figure it out. And so, for example, things like, children do better in kinship care than in other forms of foster care. Say, okay, that seems like it could make sense, but is it true? Children in foster care are over-medicated. Okay, is that true? So the way I try to figure out those things out is largely through the use of administrative data. And the reason that I like administrative data is that it captures everyone in the population within, a particular area. So I work primarily in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, and I can say, okay, I have all of the records of all of the kids in foster care, so I can make some generalizations about what's true in that population. And in both of those states, we've been fortunate to be able to partner with different agencies to link those data to other types of information. So we can say, what proportion of the kids involved with the child protection system also touch the juvenile justice system? What proportion have, particular types of mental health diagnoses? So, by linking these systems, we can get a pretty good sense of a lot of the questions that we want to understand.
So, in other words, in a sense, the process is that social workers notice problems or healthcare professionals notice problems. They report them to a central bureaucracy. You work with that bureaucracy to look at the numbers.
So in the child welfare system or child protection system, right, everything has to be documented. So you have a pretty good sense of things like what types of placements the child experienced, how they exited care, what types of maltreatment they were thought to have experienced, all these kinds of things. And then because our healthcare system, although we have a mostly privatized healthcare system in the US, the vast majority of children involved with the child protection system are actually on a public insurance.
Right.
And so we're able to then, through partnerships with government, understand every healthcare contact that they have as well.
Yeah, so this is one of those areas of social research where quite a lot of information is readily available. But I really appreciate your sharing with us, which is something I've heard from a number of other people I've been interviewing, that seeing something in, take your pick, the New York Times, the Washington Post, catches your eye and says, is that true? How does that person know that? Or whatever it might be. I think that is a really interesting stimulus to the next project, as it were. And you're an enormously productive publisher. You've published a vast array of pieces, be they op-eds or reports or scholarly articles. I wonder if you could draw a picture for us of what it's like writing for those different outlets. When you're writing something or being interviewed, you're often interviewed in the press, versus when you are writing something for a peer-reviewed scientific journal, versus when you're doing a report for an entity. What's it like finding those voices? Are they different voices? Do you use different ways of making arguments, different data, so on?
So certainly when you write for an academic outlet, you have to kind of think through, okay, what do I think this set of reviewers is going to like or dislike? And there's a lot more technical detail that you have to put in, so they can kind of verify how you carried out the research. Writing for, a public audience, that part is not really, part of the equation. It's how can you just most clearly communicate the key points that people need to understand? And you can kind of skip past a lot of the technical details. In a sense, that makes me a little bit uncomfortable because I feel like often the technical details are so important to how much you can generalize this particular story, all of these kind of things. And so there's a limited ability to give the caveats that researchers often want to give, in these more public-facing outlets because they're like, you're getting too into the weeds. You only have 500 words. Why are you talking about like a standard error or something, right? So, I think that is a real challenge, because when academics write for the public, there's often a concern that they are kind of crossing over into advocacy, or they're not being as objective and balanced as they might like to be. So I think there are pros and cons, but I'll say the reason I keep doing the more public-facing writing is because I just came to the realization that the people who make decisions are never going to read academic articles. So.
Many universities get conflicted about this. They feel as though they're under pressure to appear relevant and to look as though they're doing things that are meaningful to ordinary people. And they like the idea of the bourgeois media paying attention to them. Penn State's had lots of good media publicity and lots of bad media publicity, particularly in terms of looking after young people. And at the same time, often people within, say, a biochemistry department or an economics department want to see nothing but rigorous peer-reviewed research and nothing else counting, and don't like what are seen as popularizers. So I think this leaves a lot of faculty torn between these elements. In your case, I imagine the other thing that's relevant, because as you said, you're a professor of sociology and public policy, is that in the second part of your title, and you're in a department that is also dedicated to criminology, is what is explicitly an applied element. It is not as though this is meant to be purely sitting in the virtual library, plucking up data. This is meant to be saying, we think this is what should happen next or could happen next. Yeah.
So I'll just say, I mentioned before, I kind of see myself as an unusual fit for academia anyway, and so I kind of approach this as I'm going to do the things that I think are important, and I hope that the university will agree. But if they don't, there are lots of other jobs in the world. And so I guess I just felt like in order to do the work I want to do and be a generally happy person, that I wasn't going to tie myself to sort of the things that I thought I didn't want to spend my time on, or like not doing things that I thought were important.
Understood. And away from those polarities of the scientific journal versus the op-ed, there is also the report that is written for a third entity, and you've done some of those, which I suppose combine features of both of those other genres. Is that right?
Those are actually even a little more strange in their origin, I guess, because it's typically so I've just done yeah, so I guess I'll say I've done a little bit of writing through the American Enterprise Institute, and that's usually I'm in a discussion at a working group or with someone there, and they'll say, oh, we should put out a piece on this, or let's think about how to do this. And so those are less sort of organic in nature, right? It's kind of like, oh, we would like you to do this. Are you willing to do this in this way? And so it's more negotiated on than it is if I just want to write an op-ed or I just want to write a journal article.
Yes, that's interesting. And for listeners outside the US, who, as I said, are the majority, could you explain a little bit about the American Enterprise Institute?
Yeah, so they I would call them a center right think tank. Some people might call them a conservative think tank. They have a blend of, I would say, social and libertarian conservative types there. And they do work in a lot of areas related to social services and economics. My connection there is really through a working group that's run by Naomi Schaefer Riley, and it's a, I would say, a pretty interdisciplinary, intersector, and bipartisan group. So we try to I would say most of the working group is center left. But it's a pretty diverse group, so we try not to focus too much, I think, on the ideological reputation.
Yeah, I mean, I would it be fair to say that in the US that most important think tanks are the Brookings Institution, the American Enterprise Institute, and RAND? They'd probably be the ones that get most media and government attention.
Yeah, I mean, those certainly do. There's probably a few others that are feeling slighted if they hear this.
Sure, fair enough.
Yeah.
Exactly. Sorry, we left out some other very important acronyms. But and sometimes Brookings, which is thought of as the Democratic Party and the American Enterprise Institute, do things together, even though they are deemed to be somewhat different in terms of party politics. Separation is not absolute, as you say. And so that I really appreciate your giving us a clue about the nature of the collaborations that these pieces of writing emerge, because you're in a discussion group where you're chatting about things. And then, without any particular publishing purpose, someone at the Institute comes up with the idea of producing something, and then you go ahead and do it. And that is a very interesting alternative to the idea of your choice to write an op-ed or your choice to write a scholarly piece. So I very much appreciate that. Well, Prof, I wonder if we could get back for a moment to the drugs issue, which is where you began, and focus on that in terms of, and this again is multifactorial and controversial, but the causes of this problem, which, as you say, is experienced in many, many parts of the world. But it's fair to say it's chronic in the United States. And there are arguments that say that its criminalization tends to weigh more heavily on working people and minorities than on people who are middle class and may also be taking drugs, but don't lead lives that produce police attention. So I wondered about that as a provocation and wondered if you might also indicate what seem to be the causes of the drug problem.
Well, so I'll say there's several causes, right? So, well, in general, we know that addiction has really significant genetic factors involved, right? If you are descended from someone who had an addiction, your likelihood is also much higher, both because of hereditary factors, but also because of environmental factors. But that the sort of the decision to initiate drug use, right, is often the product of a lot of environmental circumstances. So there's issues of access. So part of the issue in the United States, drugs are really easily accessed. Right now, fentanyl is extraordinarily cheap also, which makes the barrier to entry very low. There's also, the prior role of prescription opioids, which were, grossly overprescribed and made their way into to lots of people who really didn't need them and were unaware of the risks of taking them. And in general, I think the conversation, because of criminalization and because of the harms that were done by responding to drug use primarily through incarceration, we've now moved into sort of a reverse scenario where we're underplaying the dangers of drug use. And we're saying, well, we don't want to incarcerate. Therefore, all we can do is hand out clean needles. And I guess, so I really would like to see more movement towards something that is not at either of those extremes, where we say, where we recognize the dangers of drug use, and particularly drugs like fentanyl, like methamphetamine. And we say, we want this person who is using to get treatment. We want to do that in the most compassionate way possible. And we acknowledge that they may need some sort of formal structure that requires them to receive treatment.
And Prof, when you talk about these things to people in the shops or the schoolyard or on campus in seminars, do you often get people telling you a story about themselves or their family?
I would say there's actually a recent like survey that came out in the US that was it was something like 70% of respondents said that they had been personally affected by addiction, right? Either themselves or a close friend or family member. And so everyone has a story about someone who has struggled with addiction. And it's interesting because the views of people are very heterogeneous, right? So some people will say, the involvement of formal systems made that problem worse because they were afraid of losing custody of their kids. They were afraid of going to jail. They were, or they felt stigmatized. And other people will say there was nothing else that would have gotten through. And it saved their life, right? So you hear lots of stories and it's very hard to decide which story you think is the is sort of the typical or modal one.
And getting back to children in particular, one of the debates in international law is the question of children's rights. And the US has never been very strong on the idea of children's rights for all sorts of complex reasons. Do they have any? And what are they?
So I would characterize this as a non-lawyer, to say children have relatively few rights, in the United States. So what's interesting, I mentioned earlier, there's all these lawsuits against state child welfare systems. They're only focused on children in foster care. And the reason for that is that when the state takes custody of a child, then that child has affirmative rights to receive minimally adequate care. But if a child, if child protection had gone out, saw that child and said, eh, and walked away, and then that child were seriously harmed in some way, there is actually no responsibility on the part of the state under federal law because they say children who are not in state custody do not have affirmative rights under the Constitution. So there was an interesting Supreme Court case in like the 70s about that, and it hasn't been revisited since, to my knowledge. And so it's very hard to, outside of the context of the narrow set of kids who are in state custody, to assert any rights on their behalf.
And I've got a couple more questions, Prof, and then I'd like for our conclusion to throw to you to add anything you might wish to what we've said. Does that sound all right as a way of proceeding? So, my second last query is about the question of violence and the nexus of drugs, violence, and mistreatment of children. Is there any insight you can give us on that score?
So I guess I'll say two things. So there are certain types of drugs, right, that are associated with increased propensity for engaging in violence, right? Alcohol abuse, for example, is been consistently linked to domestic violence and other forms of family violence. And similarly, things like methamphetamine or other substances that cause serious agitation or potentially psychosis can, right, lead to aggression against kids. But what we primarily see in the context of drug use in kids is neglect. So the parent is too incapacitated to respond to the child's needs. Or what we see is essentially a form of neglect that's called sort of failure to protect, which is basically that a parent who is frequently intoxicated or absent in pursuit of substances isn't able to gatekeep who has access to their child. And so then in those cases, what we see is an elevated risk of physical or sexual abuse by a partner or other people that the parent has in their orbit. So it's just a lack of supervision that can lead to abuse.
It's a sad story. So, Prof, much of what you've worked on in your adult life, almost all of it, has been with a tragic component, but also with a component of hope. How do you keep beavering away? How do you keep at it when you're confronting terrible stories and statistics?
I think I have been fortunate to have encountered a lot of people who have come from some of the worst situations that you could imagine, and they have gone on to lead healthy and, really fulfilling lives. And so I just have a lot of hope that if we can respond to the needs of vulnerable kids in a positive way, that it will really make a difference and that they can overcome a lot of the trauma that they might experience. So I just have to keep pushing for that goal.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. And is there something you'd like to add to what we've discussed today?
No, I mean, I think you had a lot of interesting questions. This was really a fun conversation.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. When you get a cold call from some dude to do a podcast, it's nice to get a response, a positive response, and even nicer to get to know you. I've appreciated it very much.
Thank you. I only over the past year have I started listening to podcasts. So now I have added your podcast to my queue. So that's I enjoyed having come across it.
Thanks.